Greetings, fellow travelers, and welcome to the Way of the Showman, where we view the world through the lens of showmanship. This is a special intermediate week, the week in between episodes. Since I am in Las Vegas and I've had the opportunity to record a few extra episodes, and my good friend Jay is arriving tonight in Las Vegas to stay with me, so I thought it was just an excellent idea to put out an special episode, because Jay Gilligan contacted me and said, I have some questions about the episodes, listening to them. I have got a bunch of questions, so I thought, why don't you just, instead of just asking me, why don't we record them? Because a lot of people might have questions about these episodes. They are very dense. I have thought a lot about it, and I'm recording this outside New York, because due to some technical issues, I am in, left it up to the last minute to record this. So the roller coaster is coming out here. People are screaming and it's all happening. And I was just going to make a very short introduction. And the rest is self-explanatory. Jay Gilligan picks apart some of the aspects of the episode and wants further elucidation from me about what the crack I'm talking about. Because some of the concepts that I am bringing up here in these episodes, the showmanship and play episodes, and he starts in episode one with the introduction and digs into some deep big questions that I fleetingly go brush past. So I hope that you can get something out of this, and if you've listened to the other one, that it might stimulate you to think about it a little more. And I will offer this opportunity up to everyone, that if you do have any questions about this, why not go to The Way of the Showman on Instagram or on thewayoftheshowman@gmail.com. Send me an email with some questions that you might have about them, and then we'll continue to make these intermittent episodes where we talk about what's going on in the other episodes to get to the bottom of this once and for all. So that's enough of a ramble. So without further ado, let's get into the ideas with Jay Gilligan. Here we go.
What I thought would be interesting after our conversations that we had off screen was that you've listened and you've taken some notes and whatever and have some questions about the episodes.
Yeah.
Great things comes out through conversation that doesn't come out through a lecture where I am presenting one line. So I thought we could just do that, and that was
that's hope. That's awesome. So that totally feeds into the same. I'm on the same wavelength as you. Basically, these snippets that I've cut out of the new season, there are moments that I thought were really full of clarity, at least from my perspective, more than the other material. I was like, oh, that's such a powerful statement. And the ones I wanted to share with you or ask you about was exactly what you just said. In the podcast, you're going forward, you know, you have a destination you're getting to. And so these points come up along the way and they have a certain meaning on that journey. But I kind of highlighted a few things that I would love for you to expand upon just in general outside of the journey of those episodes, because I think that they could use more clarification just for my personal interest, or that they're such powerful ideas that I think that they could be expanded upon more from your viewpoint, basically.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Well, do you want to just jump into the first, my first question for you?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We'll just start in the first question from the first episode.
Yeah. So it's from episode one. So I'm doing this chronologically for whatever that's worth.
Yeah. It's worth a lot.
So maybe it's good if I read the little snippet that I cut out just for context. And then after I read the snippet, because it's a little bit longer than my actual question, then I'll point to the specific part that I would love to hear more of what you think. So the snippet is, but by paying close attention to something, we are actually shaping what it is. And that goes for whether it is people that you meet or it's how you view the craft or what you do. And in our case, it's showmanship and performing, whatever. So just flag this, that there is a moral component to how we view something. And we are now going to, over the season, develop the idea of what showmanship is or what it can be, and that there is this moral component to that, and that you can choose to view it. And so my little AI transcribe, it has some glitches sometimes, but that how you view it actually helps shape what it is what you're saying.
How you choose to view it
actually helps shape what it is what you're saying. And so I think in general, this idea that we shape something, like you had said something, else in the episode too, where it's just like, hey, if you approach what you do with a certain attitude, the audience will also be able to start to potentially take on that same attitude for what we do. And I think that was one of the most powerful ideas I've heard in a long time, the way you articulated that. But what I'm more curious about is the moral component. And you and I spoke about this previously, you know, privately on another phone call. But I would love for you to tell me more. What do you mean the moral component of how we view something? And can you give some examples of then, you know, not being moral in that process? Like, where does morality come into the conversation, I guess, is the question.
Yeah, I mean, I'm drawing here on specifically on Ian McGilchrist's work, The Master and His Emissary, and recently his monumental two-book, 1,500-page opus called The Matter with Things. And so this is something that I have been thinking it for a while, and there's also elements in Rudolf Steiner's book, The Philosophy of Freedom, that within the freedom that you have, there is always this, he talks about the kind of, he calls it ethical individualism. It's like you're shaping things, but there's always an ethical component to it. But then when you're in relation to something, so that's some of where this thinking has come from. And of course, from myself to the small degree that I add something to this. And I think it comes from the idea that we participate in the creation of our own reality. And we're participating in the creation of the world by how we perceive it. So when I look at anything, then the way that I look at it and how I think about that thing allows me to see different things in that situation, whether it is that I look at a tree, or I look at, as I think that's what I talk about in the episode, where I go like a tree can be many things to different individuals and to different species and whatever. It affords to be a place where you have your nest, or it can be afford for me to see it's potentially wood that I can chop down and use to stay warm in winter. And that all of those things, it means that tree is, it is all of those things, but it is also just being itself. So it's this reality is something which is always more than, and we, by interacting with it, make it into something concrete. It then manifests itself as, yes, it's firewood. And then it becomes only that thing. And that's true. So if this is true, that, and I think it is, that this is kind of how the world works, that I come at it, like you've gone to some sort of showcase thing, and you come there and you have one idea of what it is, and then and the attitude that you bring with it is what you take out. If you were specifically looking just to get booked for one gig in this place and that didn't happen, then this was a failure. But if you were there to help build the industry and do all of that, then you and your community and making connections and relations was your aim, then that thing would have been a success. And when it 2 months later a gig comes up that, or whatever, even if it's a gig, like your wife said, even if it comes up as a gig for someone else, then that would have been a success. And so basically the idea then, it starts with this before the moral component sort of gets brought in, even though I think that just follows per definition or whatever. Like, it just follows logically from it. If the world is not just something which is there, and you can say, this is the world, and this is the tree, this is the event, this is how you need to speak, and then you will get 2 gigs. Because the world is always messy. Biology, life, the social construct of the world it's just a messy thing, and it's been always being made up. And I think that is the way that the world is. And that means that we need to put an emphasis on how we approach the world. Because it's like they say, if you have a hammer, then everything starts looking like a nail. That's a saying. And if I have the hammer and I'm looking for nails and I'm going, there are no nails here, then I am completely useless. But the hammer could potentially be other things. So that means that, and that is what the way of the showman, what I'm trying to do, is to articulate a way that I see of relating to the world and being in the world and understanding the world. And it has then to do with a particular mode of behavior or a particular way to approach the world. And in this season, we're talking about play and playfulness. And I making a long argument that this kind of attitude, the playful attitude as the world comes towards you, and you are not just expecting the world to give you one specific thing. And in those kind of games, what James Cass calls the finite games, I could win. I got 3 gigs out of doing the presentation just right, and I used the font on my thing correctly, and then I got 3 things, so I won that one. But the other game, not the finite game, but the infinite game, finite game is a game that you can win, and the infinite game is a game that you play to stay in it. It's the game that's always goal. Like, that's the two different kind of goals that he... And if you're playing the infinite game and you're just looking to what is currently being afforded by the situation to continue whatever game it is that we're in. So I believe that to be that the playfulness and having a playful attitude towards the world, a place where you can constantly create and recreate what's coming towards you. You're following the words of everything is a remix, that it's like I'm copying many different things. And I'm stealing like an artist. I'm copying, and then I'm combining all those things that I've copied, all the snippets and all that sort of stuff, and I'm transforming them into my own, that being the process. And in that relational process there, the playfulness of that creates a real art object that doesn't come out of nowhere, but this particular conglomeration or connection of things is now something that you have created. So this comes from your attitude. The work that Jay Gilligan makes is unique in the juggling world. And somebody makes something, and your brand is, or whatever you want to call it, your style is unique enough that someone might look at something that someone else have made unrelated to you and goes, this is something that Jay Gilligan might have come up with.
And really drill down now the moral part, because I almost, you touched on it for a second, but I'm still lost. Like, honestly.
Yeah. And I guess what all of what I've just said now is to build the component for that you are participating in the creation of reality. Right. It's like it's of your reality, because you created that specific artwork. You created that specific situation in your life, and how it was that you had an encounter with another person or with another event that didn't go the way that it was supposed to or whatever. And so you are now, if we accept the fact that we take part in creating the world and creating our own, you know, because I don't think that we're creating our own reality in the sort of wishy-washy thing, and that we can manifest money. We just do it. Like, it's not that kind of thing. But on a really sort of practical level, the way that you approach a particular situation affords you a particular thing. If this is the case, then it matters how you approach the world.
And just to point out then that also saying the choice of like, well, I choose not to create my own reality. That's also your choice in creating your own reality. Like you can't, is that part of it that you can't escape? Yeah. You can't escape, but to create your own reality. It's just whether you're active or passive in that process. That's a choice perhaps. But like, even if you're passive in the process, you can't escape that you're creating your own reality.
That's exactly right. So what I'm talking about here is actually, I think this is ontological, as it has to do with the nature of being. This is a fundamental way that I think that the universe works.
Okay.
I think that the world is always a multiplicity. Any phenomenon, any process or whatever is always richer than it is. That's why I keep talking on the podcast about poems, because a poem you read, and it is just, I just heard Mary Oliver's Wild Geese again this morning when I was scrolling on my phone. And yet again, I get deeply emotional and I see other things in the poem. The poem is just those same words, but I hear it read one more time for me and new things comes into my mind from this poem. It wouldn't have come into my mind if I wasn't exposed to it, but it comes. I decide to, now I want to listen to this poem in the way that you do when you are open to what it has to tell you. I'm listening to it. And in this way, I lie and I have insights in my bed and I'm having like, oh, this is, and all of a sudden the poem comes alive again and it's a beautiful thing. So I think this, you're right, that this is like a way to be, that this is a thing that you can't escape. I think it's a feature of the of existence. That's how right. It is. And if this is the case, and that's why I've said this so long, is that if this is the case and you take part in the reality, your own reality and the creation of that, if you accept that bit, then how you decide to face this conference that you've just been speaking at, how you choose to face it, the approach that you have, it matters to you because it matters to the actual reality that manifests from it in your own experience and in the people that you interact with. The things you say and everything has real impacts on real people. And in that, to me then, if you have an impact on the world for yourself first, but then on others, and even in certain things that you might have said about the artistic process that might have unlocked something in someone else, that this is then changing the way that, you know, the impact that you have had as a teacher at the school, for all the flaws that it has to be caught within an institution, you are responsible in the sense for there being a juggling act in Vegas for that has had a group of people, a core and an extended group of people who have been making a living and that have made people like a real thing has happened in the world because of influence of you. And if that is real, then you need to think through because your actions have real impact in the world. And that is the moral component.
So, okay. I start to get it. Can you give me an example then of how to act amorally or like immorally in this process? Like, can you give me a bad example of how I could manifest reality for you or for somebody I encounter or?
Yeah. I mean, yeah. So like one of the things that I sort of was interested in was when I last spoke properly, when we were at Eva Heckscher's apartment and we had sat there and we'd eaten chocolate and been chatted, and the listeners of this podcast who listens faithfully and goes on all the little journeys along the way with us have heard us talk. And I can't remember if I cut that out or whether it actually happened off mic that we were finished talking and just then he left me us with this thing of where he was gone. He said irony and how bad it is, how the bad influences of irony in the world. And that has then put me on this link and I'm finding irony and how irony is a part of the modern condition and seeing the influence of art, of where art now would, it's like Jeff Koons making the absolute kitsch thing of like he's fully doing kitsch. He's making Michael Jackson and Bubbles the monkey there, and it's being made like the porcelain figurines or whatever. But because he makes it and he deliberately makes it kitsch, he's making it ironically. And now this piece can be sold for $1 million to someone, and it's so it is kitsch, and he has made kitsch, but we are now somehow aware of it, and it's being made ironically, and now we're selling this thing again, and now it has value in another way. So that's like I'm now seeing irony in all these different places, and also when we did the show in Adelaide with Paul Dabek, and he does that I Hate Children show, which is a long story. There's a bunch of irony going on in that one because there's all the stuff that's going on for the adults or whatever. And there was one person that was like, oh, somebody was not happy about this, or maybe they even wrote a comment or something like, going, oh, you know, this is the kids don't understand irony and whatever. So it's just had these little drips here and there. And of course, everyone's laughing and it's hilarious and everything. But I've become aware about that thing. So I have, since he just mentioned it, been aware of what irony, for instance, does. The consequences of doing this is to stand on stage and to be making statements about it, but that I'm always putting them in quotation marks, or like I'm saying something, but I'm not putting my heart and myself behind it and standing fully for what I do. For instance, this is one thing that I thought, like, if
that you mentioned Ivar with the, he also hates Andy Warhol. I think he said Andy Warhol is his biggest enemy, which I think is hilarious. That he just cannot. That? Yeah, Ivar just cannot. He hates Andy Warhol more than any other artist because he finds Andy Warhol not to be sincere, and it is this ironic kind of trash, worthless kind of culture that the guy promotes just for money and fame and not like true, you know, honest reasons. Like ulterior motives and all this stuff. So maybe that's the thing. Maybe it's just the word.
I was just thinking just on that and backing him up or whatever. And it's not the topic for now, but Arthur Danto, the art historian and critic and philosopher, whatever, in his essay, The End of Art, when art ended and the art project was finished, was Andy Warhol's Brillo boxes. When he makes a recreation of something so you can't tell it apart from soap products, and that has become art. It's a long conversation. We don't talk about it here, but how it's gone from being a visual representation of it into abstraction, into becoming a copy of something that exists. And it's now through, what is it, irony or whatever it is, that these boxes that are, for all intents and purposes, indistinguishable just from a pack of soap boxes or the painting of the soup can, that we have now. And he says this is the end of art. He doesn't say that as a negative thing. Now we need to do something else, and that leads into why we can't do representational art anymore, and a fight against kitsch or fight against real emotions. Because we already did that. So we need to go somewhere else than to have real emotions being said. And I'm engaging a little bit with Odd Nerdrum and Cave of Apelles, which is two different aspects of this, bringing real emotions and just like that kind of stuff back into art or whatever, and that and figurative painting in an abstract landscape. So I can see where he's coming from and all that. And to me, it has to do with authenticity and the responsibility for what you're putting into the world.
Well, so hold on. That's exactly those words you just said I was going to say, because I want to try to like encapsulate this morality conversation, just because now it's in my brain, and see if I get it right here. But that basically, maybe it's the word moral that's tripping me up, because I'm such a non-spiritual, non-religious person. And like this idea of morals and ethics, and which I know doesn't have to be wrapped up with religion at all, but it sometimes is. And so maybe what we can say is that our actions in the world have consequences.
Yes.
And also we create the world we live in. And so I guess the moral component is what you just said. It's our responsibility to the world. So I have a responsibility to, for example, create a world that I want to live in. I have a responsibility in the world to take care of the people around me. Right? Is that, could that be the same thing as this moral component, or?
Yeah, it absolutely is. Because I'm not necessarily talking about a moral that is thou shalt do this or that.
Mm.
It's the moral actions that you live by. Like, what is the kind of person that you want to be in the world? So like, whenever you choose to, like you say, oh no, I choose not to do that, then that too is a is an action in the world, and it's a choice that you've done. And it's like Sartre talks in existentialism is humanism. He talks about probably other places, but that's where I got it, where he talks about you are the sum of what you do, not of what you think, or what you, the ideas or the ideals that you have had. It's the actions in the world that actually then defines you. It doesn't matter if you have all these grand, wonderful things to say about the world, like the problems with the Catholic Church or with what happens when people are celibate or whatever, and then you get the problems with children and abuse and whatever. Like, even though they have grand ideas, like these actions in the world shows there's something something here that is not working right. Even though they have the grandest ideals and the Pope and all these things, it is the grandest, one of the grandest spiritual structures that has manifested itself in the world. It still has its flaws and whatever.
Maybe to kind of sum up this snippet, and we can go to the next one. So let's skip the moral part. I mean, I think you covered that very well now. And let's just go back to this idea that by paying close attention to something, we're actually shaping what it is. And I just want to say one little comment and then let you maybe wrap it up on that. But the first thing that came to my mind when I heard you say that in the podcast episode, the first time I listened, it almost like slapped me in the face when you said that. Because it's this thing I've been thinking but never could articulate so well, which is that sometimes you meet these performers and either normally they're older performers and they're jaded and they're cynical and they are not interested in what they're doing. They, for whatever reason. And then yet they go on stage and expect the audience to be interested in what they do. And I think that's hilarious that, like you say, what you think about something is how is it shapes that thing. And so how can you expect to go on stage not even interested yourself in what you're doing, let alone then expecting the audience to be interested in what you do? And you can take that on the micro scale or the macro scale. And I think me and you, we are similar in the fact that we take that idea on the larger zoomed out view of these art forms that we delve into, right? So it's not just that we are interested in the particular minute details of this particular one act that we do, but rather, you know, you have all these books about the history of magic now and all these books about this and that. And we're always watching lectures and sharing conversations just on the grand scale of things. And I think that was such a powerful way to articulate that and say, like, hey, if you're a performer, and for example, if you want the audience to care about what you're doing, why don't you start caring about what you're doing? And maybe not just caring about it on the micro scale of like, what music do I play when I start my show? But maybe start caring about what you're doing in terms of like, I don't know, the history of your craft or who else is in the world doing the similar stuff to what you do, or maybe the opposite of what you do, or what... I don't know, just like performing in general, being interested in that. And it always just surprises me. It does really surprise me that I often meet performers who aren't interested in performing. And it kind of, it's hard to relate to. Maybe it's just a personality trait I have. But I think it's hard to relate to not just on a personal level, but on a professional level, because I think this performing thing is hard enough on its own, let alone not being passionate about it. Like, it's so hard to be a performer that you kind of, in my world, you just have to be completely, rabidly fanatical about it to survive. Yeah. And so it always kind of freaks me out when I meet people who are a little bit blasé about it, who are like, I do some shows, and then I see like a video of the show and I'll be like, oh my God, that trick in the middle, like, where did you get that from? Or how did you think of that? And they're just like, I don't really know. And I'm like, how can you not know? Like, that's the whole point, is that you know what I mean? I'm kind of.
I know exactly what you mean. Yeah.
Painting a feeling here for you, but anyway.
Yeah, you're painting it well. I really like that. I like the idea about being interested in your work. We should talk about that. But also just it's exactly that. And that's what the whole project of The Way of the Showman is. I have been thinking these things for a long time, and now I try to put them into, it's like basically season 1 and 2 and 4 is about, it's me talking out loud about things that I think and experiences that I've had. And it's to show that I think a lot about what I do, and how I think about it is not just to think about it on a micro level. I want to think about it in a macro level, and why my books and the things that I write and that I talk about on the podcast, it's not always, or more often than not, I'm drawing on examples, not from myself and not even from performance. Because what I'm interested in is how what we do is fits into the world on a grander scale. I'm after depth. And depth has to do with how something is connected to all other things. We experience something as deep if it, we experience a poem as deep if it connects to something deep in us and deep in the world. That this poem allows me to connect deeper to my child because I read it in this way. And then we experience depth because it's connected to all these things. And you go, it gives you a whole way in to look at the world or whatever. So that's what this project is to look at the depth of it. And the grand idea of when the publisher goes, well, who is in reading this book, and does it have any tricks in it? And does it have like, what is it? And my grand narrative of the whole idea of why what I do should have any value, it is, if you listen to you and me talk, if you listen to the conversations I've had in the last bit, or you've listened to the things that I have thought and that I tell you when I am in some sort of conversation with you, when you're listening and hopefully you're thinking that I don't agree with that, but this is connected to this and me, in that process, you are deepening your understanding of yourself as a performer and as a human being, and as in how you relate to other human beings and all of these. And as you then step onto the stage, all of this stuff that you have thought and that you think about yourself in a more grander way and in a more interconnected way, when that is part of who you are, when you go out to do your same old jokes, those jokes at least can, but I'd say they will come out. If you've just listened to me talk about how the importance of the obligation we have towards our audience, and you've just listened to how important it is to enrich them and or whatever it is, and then you go out and do your regular act, that stuff will be permeating into the way that you act in the show. And that will then, the audience will feel it. Because we can say our jokes, and we know that even all the jokes that I do, sometimes when you tell it, all of a sudden you see a new shade of what that joke or this comment or this bit of text or whatever that has, or this trick, how it could be understood. And then next time you deliver it, you can put that inflection into it, so the audience gets that subtlety from it. Mm-hmm. So that was the first thing, responding to your last stuff. But the first thing about people, older people, jaded people who have done their act so long that they're now just doing it, it's now become a job in that way that you are not trying to inspire people, and because you aren't inspired yourself, so that's not your goal, you're just going there to do the gig. And it made me think of like always trying to find these little hooks to peg it on, and in the How to Be Eccentric or whatever by Avner the Eccentric or whatever that thing, he has a thing saying that you need to be interested, not interesting. And that coming out there and genuinely being interested to be there on the stage, and genuinely being interested in meeting the audience, those things are connected, because the main thing that's new every time is you and the audience. That will never come in this configuration again. You are always the same, but you're always also changing. You've just listened to me talk about what your real obligation is every time you encounter an audience, about leaving them having the time that they have, time and attention that they've given to you, that they get that back, like a twisted Robin Hood, as I say in the thing. I give it back to them as showtime, which means it's been enriched. They feel better. They have ideas in their mind. They might go out and do something differently. So on these three levels of thought and of feeling, and look, sometimes it's enough just that you just felt so, it was just so fun and all that, but maybe there was an idea in there or whatever, that you leave them enriched. If you've heard that thing and then you go onto the stage and you are interested now, you're interested in this situation that you have as a sort of fulcrum or an axis upon which you can, you have the time and attention of these people, and what you do with it then, you, maybe that little thing that just happened, you listen to a podcast and then that brought you into it, and now you are interested in this moment that you have, this opportunity that you have of being there together with them, and in that you are now interested in the situation, you're interested in, and might even be questioning why you're doing this. You might realize that there's something lacking in your act. And in, as an extreme example, you might even voice that to them. Like, what's the point? Sometimes I'm going out here, all I do is like, I have this cheap, I'm just doing dick jokes or whatever. It's like, why do I do that? It's because you guys laugh. But is that, am I only giving you guys what you want, or what you, or am I also, am I giving you enough of what you actually need? Right. Just the same here as a reality television, where it's just, or as whatever it is, like something that just a shampoo commercial. So that comes down then to the last thing of going that I thought of, what is it that keeps me interested in it? And what is it, why am I talking about showmanship? And why is the foundational condition of what showmanship is, why is that play? And play is a relational thing. Play is a mode of being in the world. Because we can't, it's like, there's so many things that are play. There's play going on in classrooms, and there's play going on in bedrooms, and there's play going on in playgrounds, and there's play going on in intellectual conversations. And in creativity is, to all intents and purposes, it's recombinations of things. That is playful. And what is it that connects, what is the fulcrum upon all which this turns, and why am I talking about showmanship as opposed to juggling or magic, or which the people who listen to the podcast all come from, it's like, a few people are interested in acting. Some people are interested in self-development, specifically because of season two. Those who found that during that time, there's a few people who are interested in that kind of stuff, because I'm talking that I was but to me, it then has to do with, when I'm boiling all of these things down, whether you're there to help somebody through something difficult and you're a life coach, or whether you are trying to give people entertainment, maybe it's illuminated entertainment, as I call it, where there's like, I'm always trying to put as much depth into what I do without it stopping being just good times and fun times, or whatever it is that you do, that you're maximizing it and making it three-dimensional. The key thing here that I think connects us to art in general and through the human existence is the meeting with people. We are standing in front of an audience, so it's the audience that makes it real. And being interested in the audience and being interested in how you influence them means that you should then be aware of the moral component. What is it that you leave behind in them? Because when you go and the theater closes and the lights go off, they go home, and what you do completely disappears, which is partly why we have this imposter syndrome. Our results of what we do are not in the world as objects where you go, I have a big stack of shows, they are here in this. It's they carry it with them as they walk away. And if that thing was filled with hatred or bigotry or whatever, I'm not saying even if it isn't filled with that or whatever, it's just like if you just you flippantly make some remark that somebody now takes the result of what you do into something, so they go home and they now and they're sitting at home and they are
or even just that the time you spent together wasn't meaningful on any level.
Yeah, that's just a basic level that they go in and go, that was a waste of time. Like now that I'm there with Circuit Apple, Mad Apple, and they pay $100 to come and see the show. And there's like, yesterday we were taking some photos after the show and someone comes in and there's like three kids and two adults who come in. And they had the time of their lives. But you just go, I mean, hopefully they got them on Vegas.com and they got them for cheap and whatever. They paid $48 or whatever. But $48 is still a crazy amount. And you think the investment that they have done, not just in what the cash value of existence is, which is time and attention. You choose to pay attention to something for a bit of time, which is why it's such an awful thing when you're at the playground, which we sometimes do, and we are there with our kids and we're on our phone and you are not there for that unique situation of being there with your kids. Like, well, but whatever, they are there and they've invested possibly hundreds of dollars to come and see us. If we now didn't care when we went in there and we gave them, then the foundation of this experience that we're on offering is rotten. There's nothing there to it. If you're just there for the money, if you're just there for the, it's just a job I do. I don't care. I just do my tricks. I don't care. It's like, I don't like this is just, if that's your attitude, and I believe that whatever it is that our real attitude is, in sometimes in a small way, even when you don't think about it, your real attitude to things shines through. When you take charge of that and you choose to amplify it and you take that on, then your general attitude to life and your general attitude to can shine through in your work. There are, of course, like this is on a big scale. When you just go out and you just put on one bit of music and you do your juggling act and you just do the same juggling throws, you are maybe a little bit more limited than when you, for instance, do Reflex and you talk to them for an hour and you present yourself as a human being and you talk about your cares and whatever. And if so, then because I've talked about this other times, but I talk about it in season two, and I'm talking about it now every day in my mind because I'm rewriting season two into an actual book so that it will make sense not being spoken and not being added on by me commenting on what I've written currently. So, anyway, I'm losing track there a little bit on...
Let me jump in because you already segued into my second and last snippet about the first episode this season, because you just segued beautifully into it. So let me just again read the little snippet. I have a little comment about it, and then I have a specific question for you, which is kind of what you were just talking about. But all the while they see you as an authentic human. But all the while they see you as an authentic human being standing in front of them, hopefully. And what you think about what you do, it will bleed through and be visible to a greater or lesser degree to your audience. And if this is the case, and I believe it is, then how we understand what we do is of the utmost importance for ourselves, for our art and entertainment, and for our audiences. So that's everything we just said. So my comment is, you say, you know, if this is the case, and I believe it is, then how we understand what we do is of the utmost importance for ourselves. And I just want to give a comment on that to you. And then I got a question for you. And the comment is, I think what we're doing right now and what you're doing on your podcast, it's the most, I don't know if it's the most important thing you can do, but I think it's one of the best things you can do, which is to talk about process. I think process as an artist, it is the most important thing you have. I can say that. your process as an artist is the most important thing you have. And I think talking about your process with other artists, it's probably the best thing you can do. And there's this reluctance to talk about process. And I think for some people, it's because their process is intuitive. And it's the uncovering of that process that you're making it conscious that they're scared will kind of wreck the magic, right? It's like looking behind the curtain to the great and wonderful Oz. You'll just see, you'll destroy the illusion of this process. And a lot of times their self-identity and their self-worth is tied or mixed up with their process. And part of making an intuitive process conscious is defining it. And I think some people feel that whenever you define something, you are limiting it. You are limiting that thing. And they need their process. They need their self-image, because it's tied together sometimes. They need that to be infinite. They need it to be continually inspiring. And they think that, oh my goodness, if we put actual words to this intuitive feeling that I have inside of me, it's going to, you know, box me. It's going to put me in a box. And you can't put me in a box. I'm constantly expanding. And it's like, you know, Ivar Heckscher always tells the story of the shoemaker and the elves, right? That every morning the shoemaker wakes up and there's 20 pairs of shoes on his workbench. Magically, they appear and he sells them. And then he goes to sleep. And the next morning there's 20 more pairs of shoes. And this goes on. And then one night at 2 a.m, he sneaks out into the workshop and he sees the elves making the shoes. And then they see him. And because they see him, they run away and they never return. And then there's no more shoes magically appearing the next morning. And that's how I think a lot of artists feel when you start to talk to them about their process, where they're like, oh my goodness, we can't, you know, dive into this, because if we do, we're going to destroy it by even daring to try to put words to it. But dude, what you just said, and if this is the case, and I believe it is, and this is the most important thing you said, then how we understand what we do is of the utmost importance for ourselves. And I completely agree with you. And that's why I think, I don't know about having conversations about your process is the most important thing. I think it's the best thing we can do as an artist is to share our process with each other. That's why your podcast is so valuable. I think it's such an insane gift to the world, because you are just giving you're just articulating your process like for so many hours. It's just so wonderful. So I just want to say that I think that statement's super important. And as a community, and definitely like in my journey to here now, in talking to other people, there's been a real reluctance to talk about process, to talk about the work, to talk about how we understand what we do. And I just want to say that was so cool when you said that. And so that's my comment, which you can respond to. And then my question is, because the whole start of this quote was also just a repeat of everything we've said so far today, but you say, but all the while they see you as an authentic human being, standing in front of them, hopefully. And I wondered, and you touched upon it, that was the segue into this moment, but like, can you expand a little bit more upon authenticity? What exactly do you mean by authentic? I don't know. I was really curious. I was curious to hear your super personal relationship to authenticity, if you cared to share your process about that.
I mean, it's like they want to see you standing in front of them as a human being and be fully present in the moment, to acknowledge that I am here now and you are there, and what is going on in this encounter is real. I'm plowing through my act and everything, but just really also being there, and it's small things. So I won't get bogged down in those concrete kind of things. So what is authenticity? I'm just trying to state to the, and I think for them to experience you as an authentic human being, and that doesn't mean that that's not you, because you are always a million things. You're always going on and doing things in everywhere. So what we are talking about here is not how to ultimately be authentic. It is what we are hoping to do is just to create the experience of authenticity. We're creating a moment of authenticity where they feel like, and because it's real, because the experience is real. Truth is something that happens. It's not something that is. And we go, oh, that was truth because he said that thing. I can say the same thing two different nights, and sometimes it lands so that people send me an email and go, I just saw you do this, and I got one of those the other day. And this was something that happened at New Year, just after New Year's, and they were just going like, and it's still, I think about it now. And she was just talking about the amount of laughter, and then me and her, and it had been some stuff, and they had a difficult time, and her husband and me, and had seen me, and how this had been. And you go, yeah, this stuff that I did, which was just offering laughter, allowed them to have a great time. So it's, the experience is real, and it has changed in the world. But authenticity then, for me, of how can we create an authentic moment? And it is when they experience you as a three-dimensional human being standing there as a real person connecting to them as real people. And I have some stuff that when I'm saying three-dimensional human being or a three-dimensional showmanship, it's kind of the whole thing that I haven't spoken so much about there on this. I have spoken a little bit about it, but not quite like that. But what is the authenticity? It is when they feel like there is full resonance in this moment between your inner geography, what's true in you and who you are and what it is, and what you do on the stage, which is the ultimate expression and connection that you can make with them. Because I can stand there and my life kind of fallen apart, and I'm still doing the jokes with the painted face of the clown. But anyway, that was a digression. Because their experience of what is going on there, even if I'm heartbroken, is that it was good fun and whatever. So I can create an authentic fun experience, even if I don't like. But that's difficult. They can usually sense something there. So anyway, I think that authenticity comes from there being a resonance with what lives inside the performer and what's being experienced and how that manifests in the world. And sometimes you manage to do this. And the interesting, so that's my, like, if you want to take it down to a sort of one statement or whatever. But the interesting thing, I think, then, is that when I then express something and I'm doing my act, then what is being experienced as authentic, in a sense, when I'm doing that act, I am like that poem where people are seeing different things simultaneously from what I am. I am creating resonances in ways that I can't always predict. Sometimes people come up afterwards and they go, oh, the way that you say that thing. And then they give an interpretation of what I said that I never intended. But that is somehow either just giving them a great laugh or whatever, or sometimes it gives them great meaning, or sometimes they might see something religious in what I said, or sometimes they might just see it as a dick joke or whatever. Like, but all of those experiences were authentic. So I haven't got full control over what's being said. So that's why, like, the more personal that you manage to be, the more universal you can become. And how does that not just become me telling you about my situation so that it becomes solipsistic or egotistical or whatever? That comes just from the way that you approach it. If I do this because I genuinely want to connect to other people, I want what I say. I'm talking about me because that's the only thing I know. It's the only thing I have to share. And even when I take ideas from other people or whatever, it's like, if it's true for me and I can share it like that, that's all I have to share. And through that specificity of a poem, this, through the specific words and a specific encounter, even if it is just an experience of like, I watched my child and this happened, and then at the end of the poem, your mind is blown because it's about you. I get, there's a transformation that goes on in when I read the poem. The poem, the person in the poem says, I am doing this today. And then you somehow become that. That's what the novel is. I allow myself to be that other person, even if it hasn't existed, but I can live myself in, and I'm sitting here looking at these squiggles of ink on the thing, and I'm crying, or I'm feeling triumphant, or I'm whatever. Like, and these are real experiences that we take with us, and you see it in the kids when they've been in the movie theater and they watch a movie and they come out afterwards and they want to play that thing, or they want to embody that thing, and they want to be like that in the world or whatever. And the ugly thing is to go, the kids love this thing. That's why I'm selling you this plastic cape that you can put on. That's why I'm selling this to you. If you're just triggering this, there's that moral component where you go, they want to do it, but you're telling them you can only do it if you have the trademarked original plastic thing or whatever. So I don't know.
Right. No, that was perfect. I think you answered a bunch of questions I was thinking while you were talking, which is, you know, how do you personally approach being authentic, and have you ever struggled with being authentic? Or, but you covered it. I mean, this idea that talking about yourself, that is the one thing you can be an authority about, you know, like I can, when you talk about being Captain Frodo, you are the authority of being Captain Frodo. And I can buy that as a, you know, when I'm relating to you, then that's like, I can't argue that. And there's an anchor there at least to hold on to. I saw you taking some notes when I was talking about people talking about their process.
It was in regards to unweaving the rainbow, which is Keith's expression of when you go, well, how do you do this? I don't know. It's just intuitive. I just take these decisions or whatever, and that you're afraid. And the beautiful parable of the gnomes or the elves making the shoes in the night, that you're afraid that when you get, if you do get up in the night and you see the elves doing it, then the mystery will be destroyed and it won't happen anymore. But maybe there's something similar between the elves and the shoes and all that, and the kind of how when I'm doing a show, or you have an idea, or they're doing a show, and then I say something off the cuff, and it brings the house down. Mm. Then I repeat that thing the next day, and it falls flat. Because it hasn't, the situation wasn't the same the night before. Then I can leave that and not do it again, because it's clear it was a one-off thing. But the other way that you can do that then, it's like I've killed the mystery or what, I don't know. I don't know if the parallel is the same, but then I can then recreate it by aligning all of the other things, because we are in this weird situation where we aren't just living life moment by moment like most people are in a genuine interaction. We are creating we are getting to rehearse interaction with people all the time. So we can socially construct, and I can point to in the way that I'm like with attention, and by not saying it, I'm pointing, setting up things. That means when I then draw it together, like you're picking out these few quotes from what I have been talking about, and these are the things that needs to be they hit you hard, but hopefully or also they hit you hard because of the things that I'd said leading up to it. We can't just do the punchlines, even that was when you laughed or whatever,
right?
So you're recreating them, the moments there. Then you go, so in a sense, when I looked at it, and I know why that joke worked, that off-the-cuff joke, and I try it and it didn't work because it's a lot more subtle than that. And then you need to go into a whole process to recreate it. And then if you do that, which I have done countless times to make a random accident included so that it becomes an accident that looks real every night and they think that it actually happened, then you got to recreate it. And in that, like then you got to use your process to arrive back at that. So you can kill the magic by looking at the thing. But what I like, so that was one picture of it, but let's just skip past because it doesn't fit quite as well. But Keats wrote, you know, he's like, you unweave the rainbow, and as you do, you kill the rainbow, and it's not beautiful anymore. The magic is gone. The magic is killed, because now you know. And he's talking specifically about Newton and how he made optics and works out this is why there is a rainbow. And then Keats goes, you just unwove the rainbow and now it's sort of dead or whatever. I mean, there's more to it than that, but that's the easy thing.
Yeah.
But what, and this, we spoke about this on the Golden Brick at one point there. And, yeah. As much as I look at my process and as much as I look at what it is to try to understand showmanship, to try to understand what it is I do, which is ultimately just trying to understand why I have these inclinations and why I am spending my life doing this and why I, who I am as a human being, then I try to understand it. And I spend so much time now that I spend these 30 episodes exploring this attitude that I think that I aspire to have, this playful attitude towards things, to see them for what they are and blah, blah, blah. And as much as I do that, and as much as you and me spent a whole year, 6 hours a week talking about the creative process and all that, making Reflex, still, after saying all of these things, that all the preparation that we did and trying to talk about process and all that, when we then are sitting there and you and me are in the hangar out at Butzkirchen or whatever, or whatever it's called out there, and and we're working on Reflex, and and there's something that isn't working, and I'm jamming with you to try to make it. Or I just did it now with TJ Salter here on he's working on his new act or whatever in Vegas. And when I am jamming, where those ideas come from, how it actually manifests in that moment when I'm in the flow and I'm just going, how about this? How about this? So there's something that isn't working, and I'm trying to throw three different angles at it to see what ignites a feeling of authenticity in you when we did Reflex, or him when we're looking at this act. He's stabbing in, or he's looking into territory that he's not going into normally, or you going into something. And then how that actually emerges, for as much as I have thought about three-dimensional showmanship and thought feeling and action and all, how much all of this stuff and the elves and the killing, the mystery and all that, in the moment when I'm saying it, and then we both laugh and we go, that's the key there, that's it, that just unlocked it, and then we move on, I still don't know exactly what happened in that moment. I tried my thing in it, but somehow it's like, I've thought this before, but it's like the hokey pokey where they go, it's like you put your left leg out, you put your right leg out, and then you do the hokey pokey and right, and that's what it's all about. And you go, yeah, oh, that's what it's all about. And you go, no, but you were following me closely there. I did the left leg out and the right leg out. And then you do the hokey pokey, and then it's all what's all about. And then you go, but what's the hokey pokey here? You just pulled a move on me. The hokey pokey is the moment where something happens, where the idea comes out, and you just say something. We had a sort of moment like that here with TJ when he was sitting right where I'm sitting, like sitting on the side there, and he. And we go, oh, and then this is, and then the knife hits him right, the hits the doll right in the groin or whatever we came up with. It's like, and that just undid the whole, I had to rethink everything now because all of a sudden the whole parameter of what the act would be then up until then was like, yeah, this is, and now like you have these tiny little, and where did that specific idea come from? Well, it's like I remember you said something to Eva where it's like, oh, thanks for sharing all of this stuff. And he said something like, I didn't know any of these things until you and me spoke now.
Yeah, yeah.
And you afforded me the chance to say those things because they didn't exist until this conversation. And that's that, can wrap it up on that because that was like,
yeah,
that's that we are creating something, and that thing is the relation between you and me, and we are both participating in the creation of reality. We're creating these relations and the connections that comes through that conversation. Now this is the one thing, but then you take it with you and maybe put it into your work and it reflects out further, and I take it into myself from having listened to you guys talk, and I take it into my writing and my thinking and my way of being in the world. So it keeps coming down to these meetings and what they actually mean and what they genuinely then afford us for change in the world, for change to ourselves, or for understanding ourselves in the world.
Amen, brother.
Good stuff. Thanks for that.
Dude.